Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Italian Studies. I'm your host, Kate Driscoll, Assistant Professor of Italian and Romance Studies at Duke University. It's my joy and tremendous pleasure to be joined today by my dear colleague and friend, Jessica Gettles, recently minted Associate Professor of Italian at the University of Alabama, who is also currently a long-term research fellow at the Newberry Library in Chicago. Dr. Gettles' research centers on medieval and early modern literature and theater, focusing especially on gender and women's writing, the relationship between military historical events and their literary representations across genres, the intersections of print, manuscript, and performative media, mysticism, prophecy, eschatology, and rhetoric. Dr. Gettles' first monograph and the conversation topic for this afternoon is titled Margherita Costa, Diva of the Baroque Court, published in 2023 with the University of Toronto Press. This authorial achievement ushers forth the first full-length study of Margherita Costa, the remarkable courtesan, professional singer, and prolific author. So, Jessica, welcome. I'm so glad we get to have this conversation today, and toast to your new wonderful book.
Hello, Kate, and thank you so much for inviting me to come talk about this extraordinary figure of Margherita Costa with you and your listeners. I'm really grateful for the opportunity. Okay. she's a delight and a fun time.
She is. A great conversation topic. So the first question just has to be right out the gate. Where did you meet Costa in your literary research trajectory? How did you know when you struck that amazing relationship with her that you wanted to write a book about her? Where did she meet you along your journey?
So I first discovered Costa while I was working on an altogether different century and a very different subject. I was still a graduate student at NYU, where I had the great fortune of having stupendous mentors and a set of colleagues who the kind of common line between us is that many of us were interested in or invested in studying and thinking about the place of early modern women and gender. And thinking about its ideals, its practices, and its faces. And so what I hope now is that with this book, Margherita Costa becomes recognizable as one of those important faces. But at the time, I was working on a dissertation on the 1527 sack of Rome, and was reading stacks of very brutal descriptions of torture. And so, as you might imagine, I was in need of a little bit of levity. So at one of our big national conferences, and my memory is that it was the MLA, I was musing with one of my then NYU colleagues, Sarah Diaz, who's now at Fairfield University, about whether an Italian Renaissance woman had ever written a comedy. So we poked around and learned that the answer was yes, a comedy called Li Buffoni, The Buffoons, written by a 17th century professional singer who was also one of the period's most prolific and visibly successful women, but about whom relatively little attention had been dedicated. So when we got back home, we kind of mused about this a bit further and realized that we would like to translate that work, both because it was unexpected, unknown to us, and really as a work in itself, a lot of fun. So we did that with the Other Voice series that furnishes a lot of translations of early modern women's work, in our case, in a bilingual translation. And in that same period, I also happened while in Florence on the manuscript version of Costa's horse ballet libretto, a subject to which I imagine we'll want to circle back, and ended up writing a substantial article on that for Renaissance Quarterly. So I had in this moment a fair amount of momentum and interest and knowledge built up about her. And I was, again, still for the Sack of Rome work, happened to be a summer at the Folger Shakespeare Library, which despite its name, has a good number of materials for Italianists as well. And while there, I realized that they had one of the biggest collections in the world, and certainly in North America, of Costa's works, texts that they didn't quite yet know that they had because they were still going through the process of cataloging the non-English material. So I told them that they had this wonderful collection, asked for a fellowship to come study it. And so then found myself with a full year fellowship and momentum and decided to table the sack of Rome and dedicate myself to Costa. And if I had been spending all this time thinking about misery and torment and death with war in the 1500s, Costa couldn't have been more different. So she is, as I mentioned, a professional singer in chamber and opera contexts, active in cities like her native Rome, Florence, Turin, Venice, Paris, who is able to accumulate the best of the patrons, the Medici family in Tuscany, the Barberini papal family in Rome, Cardinal Mazarin and Queen Anne in France. Queen Anne was at the time the regent for Louis XIV. And addressing her writing across a multitude of genres and registers, and for especially her most important patrons, the Medici, her appeal for them was based in her ability to write in kind of burlesque, salty, and unexpected ways. And that's part and parcel, of course, of what the Baroque period was, but it was unusual for a woman writer who was expected to show decorum. We can think about Costa's predecessors like Vittore Colonna, who wrote about her dead husband and glorifying his memory. But Costa, because I think she was a singer, and singers in this period were seen as marginally and as sexually available, she was already somehow on the limits of decorum anyway, and so didn't have those same constraints on her writing, and could embrace the theatricality, the flair, and the playfulness of Baroque aesthetic.
That's great. I mean, if that doesn't sell enough of not only the book, but the desire to study Costa as a topic, choosing her over the sack of Rome, I don't really know what else would. So the book is just, it's so spectacular. And as you say, I mean, one of the things that makes Costa such a fascinating figure is this dance that she choreographs with her authorial persona, always between the spectacular and the literary. And this comes through so well in the cover image to the book. So we have to start on the outside in order to work our way into the nitty gritty. I think we all just need to know more about this image, where you found it, how did this image speak to you as the cover image into the world of Margarita Costa, with this woman playing the Spanish guitar whose gaze is looking elsewhere, but whose mouth is open. She's on the precipice of doing something amazing, even in the act of playing. And so what's the story behind this image here?
Well, Kate, I'm so delighted that you like it. I'm rather fond of it too. And I'll tell you that it was the last piece of the puzzle to fall into place. And I actually had to rewrite the introduction in order to incorporate it. Because I had in my mind to have as the cover image, one of the two portraits that are done of Costa by her contemporaries, one anonymous, one by one of the famed draftsmen of Florence, Stefano della Bella. But as the editor pointed out, there, A, in black and white, and B, have shown up on the covers of other texts about Costa, not excluding my own translation of her buffoon comedy. So my editor has suggested a number of really spectacular images of female performers, what look to be primarily actresses in an ensemble setting. And they would have been gorgeous. But the only problem with that for me was that Costa was never part of a troupe or a company. She was something of a, if not a lone wolf, at least a free agent. And so portraying a group, a company of some kind on the cover seemed disingenuous to how I saw her operating in her own day. So that was problem number one. And then I guess my next impulse was that I wanted to somehow be able to incorporate an idea of who she could have been while also giving a nod, as a performer, I mean, and then also giving a nod to her literary enterprise, which is really the meat of what I'm looking at in this book. So as you say, the portrait that we have on the cover is of a singer playing the guitar. It's by Simone Vouet, and it now hangs at the Metropolitan Museum in New York City. So she's strumming in a guitar, and the image might best be described as sultry. And I'll add that my university has this really delightful tradition of taking faculty book covers and blowing them up poster size and hanging them, framing them and hanging them in the various university departments. So I really love the idea. I'm tickled by the idea that this sultry portrait will be in my hallway one day. That's so cool. As you note, Kate, her the singer's fingers on the guitar, she's turned her head, her lips are open as though she's either about to sing or lost in thought, maybe both. The light is Caravaggesque. We can't help notice that she has these green satin sleeves and one of them is slipped from her shoulder. And so she's showing a little bit of flesh there. And then the lighting frames her breasts right above the guitar. So she is provocative in a way. And Simone Veau was a French artist who's active in Rome in the first decades of the 17th century, a moment when there's quite a bit of demand for images of female musicians. It's not clear who this particular singer was, the one that we see portrayed here. A hypothesis is that it might have been the artist's wife, who was both a painter and a musician herself. But for me, what matters most is that the portrait's executed in a moment and in a city where Cosa was also active. So even if it's not her per se, we can imagine that it could be her. And the image of this woman is not altogether dissimilar from those portraits of Cosa that I mentioned. So it's emblematic of a figure like her. And what was especially appealing to me is that the Costa's first major publication of her own was called La Guitarra, the guitar. This is a massive collection of love poetry, about 600 quarto pages, so kind of full pages. A lot of it rather salty in nature, much like this the sitter. And in the dedication to that work to the Grand Duke of Tuscany, Fernando II de' Medici, Costa describes how she sees the position of the guitar at court. She says, you know, as many people in her own day would lament, it's too lowly, it's too pedestrian, it's not sufficiently elite. But nonetheless, everyone else liked it, desired it, and wanted to hear it play. And that's how she also presents herself. So for me, in this portrait, Costa is akin both to the woman, the sitter herself, and the instrument that she's holding.
That's beautiful. And even just as you were bringing us through your visual analysis of the image, for some reason, just describing the light as in the style of Caravaggio really brings out just the flush in her cheeks, right? She's so mm-hmm. alive in this moment. And that's so different from the very staged kind of beautiful authorial portraits, which are included in the volume. And so everyone can still check those out. But there's something so very like alive and conversational already in this image that I think does a beautiful job of bringing in the figure of Costa as this figure that's in dialogue and in musical dialogue. So I really love that.
Yeah, certainly here she's not buttoned up. She's
not in
those other portraits.
No. She wants you to know something, and she's inviting you on to maybe like play a role in finding that out. So lovely. So staying then on the cover, I think another one of these kind of great you used the word just now, emblematic. So another one of these great ways of thinking about Costa that you argue in the book, and you really argue very beautifully and convincingly, has to do with the term diva, and when maybe we think of that term, we might associate it right away with kind of the actress tradition. And I really liked your reading just now of kind of pushing against the framing of Costa as someone who's kind of made possible simply because of an ensemble of other people doing what she's doing. In many ways, she's very unique, even if she's mm-hmm. recalling that her tradition. But the word diva that you bring out in the book has these different meanings that she's tapping into at different times, whether that's the diva in this burlesque, salty is one of my favorite Jessica words that you use. But then diva also, I mean, she's also the author who's writing about Saint Cecilia and the kind of spiritual dimension of the diva that has this supernatural connection. So can you spell out kind of the few different ways that diva worked through the book while you were making it? Is that something that you decided on early, or kind of like the cover sort of came through as an organizing principle later on?
I did start off with this title, and I was never sure right until the moment in which the book landed in my hands that it was going to stay the title, because I was maybe carrying a doubt that wasn't a fair description of Costa, because she had fame in her own day, but she wasn't the most famous of the singers active in this moment. Others like Leonora Baroni, Barbara Strozzi was active in music. Her own sister, Anna Francesca Costa, was arguably more famous than she was. But why I was drawn to and stuck with this idea of Costa as diva is that she's a figure that I think employs to great advantage, and practically so, displays of her own virtuosity, not only as a singer, not only within the chamber, but and on the stage, but also in her relationship to her patrons, her ability to mold her identity, literary and otherwise, to their expectations and appetites, and also to really demonstrate virtuosity in her publications. So as I mentioned before, she's really spanning nearly all possible genres. So under her name, we have history writing, we have various forms of lyric poetry, love poetry, funeral poetry, occasional poetry, a number of performative works. So of course, her burlesque comedy, The Buffoons, but also several different libretti, various short epics and the like. So she's really showing off her ability to do all things also through writing. As you say, the idea about what a diva was in transition from the late 16th and 17th centuries, marking a departure from the original meaning of the word, which was not kind of as we associate it today, this kind of capricious, uncontrollable, proud female performer. At the time, originally, the word diva was more associated with the divine, so the sacred realm, a kind of female deity. And that shifts as we have the arrival of kind of prominent celebrity female performers, the celebrity actress and the singer, particularly visible initially with the phenomenon of the Commedia dell'arte tradition and actresses like Isabella Andreini. And I'd be remiss if I did not mention here two great books by colleagues, Rosalind Kerr, The Rise of the Diva on the 16th century Commedia dell'arte stage, and Pamela Allen Brown's The Diva's Gifts to the Shakespearean stage. So people who, scholars interested in theater have already kind of pinpointed this trajectory towards divahood, if we can coin that word. Mm-hmm. So thinking about professional or prominent singers and actresses that were kind of drawing audiences, that were reaching celebrity status, necessitated new ways of praising them and their skills. And so one of the initial impulses is to liken them to the divine. So the diva kind of slides from being about kind of sacred qualities to an appellation of celebrity. So moving into the performing arts, I think, as you mentioned, Kate, one of the ways in which we see this really come forth in Costa's work is a hagiographic opera that she writes about the figure of Saint Cecilia, who's a virgin martyr in Rome. Costa was, of course, also from Rome. The women also share an interest in music. Saint Cecilia is the patron saint of music, and often, especially over time, increasingly depicted as either associated with music or eventually in the Baroque period playing music. And so Costa returns to Rome from her period in Florence, needing to court new patrons, specifically the Barberini. The Barberini nephews are her most close interlocutors, and their uncle, of course, is Urban VIII. By happy coincidence, Saint Cecilia's kind of religious intercessor and pope at her time is Urban I. So Costa kind of cleverly draws a nice parallel between these two figures and writes a four-canto hagiographic opera about this singing saint and her relationship to the Pope Urban. And in one of these cantos, there's a kind of henchman who is sent to do the second attempt to kill Saint Cecilia. So first they tried to boil her alive, but she just sang the whole time in Costa's version and emerges unscathed. And the second time he's there to behead her. And as he arrives in her house, he sees her, hears some kind of celestial music around her, which is how we would, in the kind of long iconographic tradition, associate Cecilia with sacred music. But then this Cecilia is sitting in an organ and she begins to play. And essentially she's bringing down the house, right? Her music is so amazing that the henchman is momentarily tempted to not go forward with his kind of bloody, brutal task. And then he calls into question, well, what is the nature of music? Maybe she's seducing me rather than anything else. But we see this moment in which Costa is playing with the idea of the diva as it's transitioning. So diva as the sacred is this martyr saint, but diva as the tremendously capable, skilled, and virtuosic musician is also Cecilia in that moment. And so, of course, throughout this poem, in order to appeal to her Barberini patrons, Costa is kind of sprinkling in associations of herself with the saint. She notes from the beginning that that's a somewhat problematic association because she is a kind of, as you say, salty singer with a certain reputation and began her career as a courtesan, but she professes to be newly penitent. And so she wants to have a relationship to her Urban like Cecilia had to the original Urban I. And so she implicitly in this is also pointing to herself as a diva figure.
That's lovely. Thank you. And I couldn't help but also kind of hear the some trace of a potential parallel with your own experience in giving up the sack of Rome and in converting to Costa, and the idea of, you know, abandoning the language of the tragic and the assassination and the murderous attempt, and then you yourself found Costa in this kind of Saint Cecilia parallel like way. I mean, it's what you're describing. I mean, she just had so many fascinating interests that she advanced from. She was able to find things that she was interested in that also interested her and interested her relationship then with her patrons. And the book starts this story of her constant dialogue with different patrons from her role as an editor of the Grand Duke, as a teenager, the Grand Duke Ferdinando II de Medici's trip up to a different court across the Alps. And so the story of Margherita Costa, this incredibly prolific writer, starts then as Costa, the incredibly careful editor. And I really enjoyed that chapter a lot because I find women's early modern women's history with historiographical writing really underdeveloped. And I think that this will just blow open lots of exciting doors for new kinds of research. And because then the later chapters turn more and more to this, her navigating different relationships with either other Medici patrons or even the Barberini, as you're explaining, or even figures up in France. What do you think then the impact, like what's your sense of that impact in narrating the Grand Duke's ventures and the amount of space that text leaves open for the Grand Duke's own interest in spectacle? And so here she is, she's editing this text, she's reading about what the lives of patrons are lives, and she herself is about to embark on her own life of writing all sorts of different kinds of texts of spectacle materials. And so is there a kind of relationship that you think she starts to be fairly aware of in that sort of kindred spirit, like framing between her own interest in spectacle and clearly what her patrons were interested in?
Yeah, it's a really fascinating question, especially because this is her first work. And, you know, we're kind of, I think, calling it in our conversation an edited text that she brings forth. But my calling that, I think, within the kind of historiography of a figure like Costa will itself be somewhat audacious, I think, because it's usually treated as, or at least in contemporary scholarship, treated as one of her authorial productions. Her own contemporaries highlight the fact that she acknowledges in her dedication materials or paratextual materials that she actually relied on the papers given to her by the Grand Duke's secretary. But there's, I think, because women's writing has so long been dismissed, or there's been a temptation to strip away women's authorial achievements, that there's been a temptation to call this her work when I think increasingly, as I worked on it, became convinced that we can't see her as anything other than the editor rather than the author of this work. And the text itself, I should take a step back and say this, it's a meticulous history of Ferdinando II's 1628 journey up to the court of the Holy Roman Emperor in Prague. The Holy Roman Emperor happens to be his uncle. And he is already the Grand Duke of Tuscany, but he's still in his minority. So his father had died in 1621, and his kingdom or his principality has been ruled by his mother and his grandmother for the last 7 years. So this is kind of his coming of age trip. He'll go down to Rome and then circle all the way up the Italian peninsula, all the way to Prague, and then come back. And the text itself is a day-to-day account of his movements, the various diplomatic niceties and protocols, who got out of the carriage first, who stepped forward last, et cetera, et cetera. And mentions, most importantly for us, of the many entertainments that were staged for him along the way. And his trip is kind of neatly tied to his birthday. So he returns to Florence on the day of his 18th birthday and assumes power and now is, in all senses, the Grand Duke of Florence. The materials that Costa draws on are relazioni, these reports that were sent back from people in the Grand Duke's entourage back to the two regions. And so I, in the Archivio di Stato di Firenze, I found all of the original materials. And so she's made some light adjustments, but what she's really done is brought them together into a whole and kind of given them a framing. And I think that's an important distinction to make because this history kind of sits apart from the rest of Costa's corpus, not only because it's the first publication, but her other writings, even though, as I mentioned, they span genre and register, some are quite serious and dynastic in nature, some are kind of off color, more than sexually suggestive, and tend towards the poetic. This is a very, very dry diplomatic history. And so even on first read, it seems at odds with Costa's productions. And so when we recognize that Costa did not author this, but edited it, brought it into being, it does raise the important question of why such an important work for the identity of the Grand Duke of Tuscany, why such a work was given to an at then point unpublished Roman female singer who until recently had been a courtesan. So why is this being published on her name, under her name? And I think that's not that question is not yet answerable, but it's very clear that she got institutional help, if not an outright commission to do it. So it's her kind of entree into the publishing world and clearly helps her bridge a relationship with the Medici that will last throughout her career, throughout her life. It has its ups and downs, but it's not some pirated work she's done. It's something that's really bridging her relationship to this patron. And I think again, it is a dry diplomatic history. And I think Costa, in putting it together and stitching together, recognized that. And then reading through these official documents that are being sent to grandma and mom about his experience, what she likely realized is that the then 17-year-old Grand Duke, because of course he's turning 18 on the day he arrives, while he's taking this journey over the course of 6 months to Rome and all the way up to Prague, when he's going to processions, orations, religious plays, he's very often bored. And that's something that, those of us who teach freshmen, it's not an unfamiliar phenomenon, right? Try as they might, the poor folks of Venice sometimes just can't capture his attention. And even things like banquets and masquerades for him often grow dull, and he expresses a desire to skip them, even if kind of diplomacy does not permit him to do so. And the moments of levity in that text are moments in which Fernando II is either himself organizing or being exposed to other kinds of less stuffy, less official entertainment. So for example, while traversing the mountains after it had snowed, he himself organizes a race of mountain villagers who are wearing these kind of big clunky snowshoes. So he likes, I think she's identifying that he likes to be entertained in these kind of more carefree, more satirical, more playful ways. And she brings some of those lessons into her own writing. So for example, in her comedy, The Buffoons, one of her favorite scenes is a moment in which she has a court buffoon who's performing for the princess on a riding stick, a kind of broom, instead of pretending it's a horse, and then falls off of it to dramatic effect, right? Or to humorous effect. So what she sees in this is that the Grand Duke and his brothers enjoy revelries, entertainments that are often off color. And so I don't know that we can necessarily say that she sees him and him, the Grand Duke, a kindred spirit, or that her outpouring tends to respond to his interests and are designed to capture his attention. But the other lesson, besides the kind of goal of entertaining such entertainable patrons, is that she understands, I think, that the importance of incorporating kind of dynastic messaging or political messaging desired by a patron into her writings. And so it's not just that she has these 14 publications that she kind of dashes off to various patrons and that's it, and thanks them for their help and their graciousness and dedicatory letters. Her patrons are insistently, repeatedly woven into her text as a primary focus of what she's doing. And I think that I can't help but think that the act of editing a diplomatic history at this very initial stage of her career helps drive home that message. But at the end of the day, I think that what she what she really takes away is that what is permissible to her as a female writer is going to be much more vast. And that's especially in the case of a place like Florence, where the Medici are at the helm, so that she can do things like write a comedy that is a parody of their court, and where the various characters are what she calls freaks of nature that are based on historical figures in the Medici employ and who kind of fall over themselves and have a riotous time and are drunk and carnal and having fun. She can insert dwarves and hunchbacks into her poetry. She can describe her own writing as monstrous in a way that will be appealing. And so I think her relationship, what she sees in Ferdinand, is letting her push the boundaries of what she imagines a woman writer could do. Now, when she moves to other courts, that's not the same phenomenon. A woman in Rome cannot push the boundaries in that same way. And so then we're going to see her pivot to writing a hagiographic epic about a martyr saint, for example.
Yeah, that's so instructive too, because I mean, then it reveals then how much the Medici modeled for her that the political is by no means divorced from the playful. I mean, I don't think I've ever heard a case of snowshoe wars being so inspirational to any figure in our time period. So that's just really, really, really fabulous. Elsewhere throughout the book, as you're already hinting at in these answers that are reminding me that how much I want to go back and reread things. You underscore throughout this language that she was an astute monitor of taste, and that those are your beautiful words. And you've already described that she's monitoring taste from the burlesques to the sacred, from the salty to the less sultry. And so in this sense, I think reading your book, of course, with these musicians' ears of mine, I couldn't help but then also think about Costa as this wonderful producer, this incredibly prolific author, but as this just very careful listener. And she's sort of this mm-hmm. ideal musician to play music with, because she listens as much as she gives, you know, as much as she's putting out there. And she has her ears to the ground in contemporary history in different ways. And I know that the one of the chapters that I really, really loved, because it's opening up new ways to think about epic and women's epic especially, has precisely to do with, as you're saying, this relationship between Costa and the Medici. Mm-hmm. So for those who are about to go dive into your book, if you can give us a little preview of her dynastic epic for the Medici family, and if you can answer this, I know that it might be a little bit of hypothesizing, but what your sense is of Costa's sensitivity to these different historical moments and her own kind of planning of her work. She wrote so much. So mm-hmm. Do you have a sense that she sort of knows in advance a little bit of what she wants to write, or are things kind of occasioned because of historical circumstance, or do you have a sense of that after writing the book?
That's a fabulous question. And I really wish that I had a more definitive answer. I have some hypotheses I'm going to share with you, but I would love to have a more definitive answer. And what I think is, one of the challenges still for those, I hope, that are going to take up the baton and work additionally on Costa, is that for a woman who wrote so prolifically and published so prolifically, she left so limited numbers of items, traces in terms of her autograph material, or that material hasn't survived or hasn't been located. And so it'd be delightful if we had, and certainly helpful if we had, more of her letters, for example, that explains her thought process. So mostly what we have to go on are the, aside from some select letters, what we have to go on are her texts herself, themselves. And I think, you know, we can see her, I think I because she is a performer who traveled, I think in very practical terms, she is likely carrying her materials from one court to another, trying to see what might fit, you know, how can she put a certain peg in a certain hole where she's traveling. And she gives us a glimpse of this in a wonderful autobiographical poem that is actually a poem of complaint about how she's been treated. And this is, I should say, one of her favorite themes, is that she is oft mistreated, oft misunderstood, not by her current patron, of course, but her former patrons or their residents, writers, other women at whatever city she's just left. So in this autobiographical poem, she is in Florence, been started, she describes starting to write there to some acclaim, but then some various voices start to disparage her. And so she storms off, she says, with all her writings from her time in Florence, but also previously in Rome, under her arm, and she's heading off to go complain to Apollo himself. And Apollo, when she gets to him, is essentially going to A, reassure her that she is indeed a good writer, but two, he's going to tell her that she needs to begin to vary her writing style, not just the saucy poems and letters that she'd been working on theretofore, but to really open up her kind of genre capacity. I think we see this in this carrying around of her works in very practical terms in the case of her equestrian ballet libretto, which she writes as part of the dynastic work she intends for Ferdinando II in Florence. I think my guess is in celebration for a child that that quickly died. And so she can't get to stage in Florence, but, you know, later the next decade, she's in Paris and she reproposes it for the Parisian court, recrafts it. Because the overlaps of the texts are so close, it means that she must have been carrying this work around with her. So I love the idea of a Costa who is moving from city to city, singing, performing, writing, and also has a portfolio of sorts in her bag. There is another great example in an unfinished manuscript. There's a couple of texts that she has that are in manuscript version. One of those is that equestrian ballet libretto. But another one is a manuscript poem that begins a burlesque text about the various entertainments at court. So she's got a canto on banquets, comedies, games, hunts, and it's really quite daring. The first canto has the main character, who's named after herself, of course, Margarita, who is trying to fight off a kind of grabby, handsy cardinal with a bedpan. But then the circumstances change. It's either that she's moved from Florence to Rome, or her patron, Camillo Pamphili, has just risen in stature because his uncle has just become Pope and he's about to become cardinal. So all of a sudden, it looks like she's lobbed on two additional cantos that are about her conversion, and that she is now going to be the kind of repentant figure. And she titles the whole project, The Journey to Loreto. Loreto is, of course, the city where famously the home of the Virgin Mary is transported. So she gives a sacred veneer, but doesn't go back and revise that first canto where she's, you know, having to push away the hands of this libidinous cardinal. And you asked specifically about her dynastic work connected to the Medici. And I think really indicative of this is a short epic that she writes during and for the pregnancy of the Grand Duchess, Vittoria della Rovere. So she structures it that there are going to be nine cantos for each nine of the 9 months of the Grand Duchess's pregnancy. As I mentioned a moment ago, the child dies within just a couple of days. And so Costa, kind of faced with what to do, doesn't table the text, but asks permission to still publish it if she can adapt it. And so she adapts it by adding a 10th canto, in which Jove decides that the child is just too good for this earth. And it's a kind of apotheosis scene where he's carried up into the heavens. But really, in a way that I find flabbergasting, later that year, she decides to rewrite the work in its entirety, now as a drama, and to my eyes, an opera libretto. And that's a great case in which I would really love to see a letter explaining why she decided that a text that she had to kind of bandage up in order to get published because its topic was so delicate after the death of the child, why she recrafted it as an opera libretto, and not only, but dedicates it, if the original epic was dedicated to the Grand Duke, she now dedicates it to the Grand Duchess, this opera libretto. So why she does that, I do not know, but it shows the degree to which she is kind of constantly kind of tinkering with, rewriting, recrafting her works.
It's got to exist. There's got to be a secret letter in some archive.
If only.
Only. That's what we all actually just fantasize about, is right. I'm still waiting to find things by Tasso that explain these similar little mysteries.
They could have done us a kindness by leaving us some extra clues.
Exactly. No? Right. No, they didn't write enough. these two authors. So now is the grand expose into one of these genres that has now been mentioned a few times, but I imagine that for Many, many listeners, and for many even experts of early modern Italy, the equestrian ballet is going to sound new, and in ways that I hope that soon it will not sound so new. But yeah, that we'll know more about this really, really spectacular form of performance, on which your early scholarship was award winning. So we have to always congratulate that. Yeah, so I guess just if you could provide context into when we say equestrian ballet, you know, what comes to mind, and if we could also tie this to the kind of question of the reception of the Baroque, like is the equestrian ballet this genre that has been unfortunately sacrificed in the history of knowing things about 17th century Europe, in part because of the Baroque sort of shady association by certain critics, especially from the art historical trends, who made like early versions, right? Who saw the Baroque as being overly excessive and lacking severity, lacking gravitas. In the process of that historiographical language, did we lose the equestrian ballet, and how is Costa kind of excitingly bringing it back to us and bringing us back?
Yeah, I think it's such a great point, because the Baroque has suffered from various lines of attack, and I think that it is still encumbered, particularly as regards Italian literature. Baroque is still something of a four-letter word in Italian literature, in a way that it's no longer, not always, in art. For example, if we think about Bernini's statues, no one's arguing for their lack of validity or importance. Right. Or music, if we think about the outgrowth of opera, is more the case, I think, in Italy as compared to places like Spain. And Kate, as you yourself know all too well, it's really the Italian intellectuals and writers of the late 17th century themselves who really put the kibosh on Baroque aesthetics and dismissed the first half of the century as this era of bad taste. And so for so long, how could you possibly dedicate your time and energy to studying the era of bad taste, with maybe some small exceptions carved out for figures like Giambattista Marino, and then still with some caveats, no? And so if we think about kind of the grand scholars of Italian early modern literature, like Benedetto Croce, he had a really low opinion about the Baroque. He had a really low opinion about women's writing. And for him, the two meet in Costa, and he just absolutely disparages her as kind of a scribbler of no value. And I think it's only now that we're climbing out from under that blanket of condemnation of the Baroque. And so certainly equestrian ballet has been a victim, likely, of that pushing away of an entire century's worth of activity as inappropriate, unworthy of scholarship. I have a suspicion, too, that part of the lack of familiarity with something like equestrian ballet that was so delightful and just absolutely wowed audiences of the day is that we associate it with Vienna and dressage. And for those who are interested in horsemanship and dressage, pardon me if I say that maybe in contemporary vision, dressage is seen as something that is kind of a silly activity of the elite. And I've been convinced and won over to the idea of dressage as an art form. But I think that there's a lack of recognition that the equestrian ballet was this kind of almost Broadway of the 17th century, right? That is bridging medieval practices and emerging performance forms. So on the one hand, we have jousts and tournaments. On the other, we have the new emerging forms of opera and court ballet, ballet de cour. And what's fascinating to me about equestrian ballet is that while musicians and singers would provide the acoustic backdrop, the participants in the ballets were themselves the prominent men of the city or of the court. Moreover, these ballets have, of course, they have poetry, they have choreography, they have brilliant colors, great music, stage entertaining, engineering with machines. So we might have a giant figure of Atlas walking across the outdoor arena for a Medici performance. They're really a multimedia phenomenon that truly, as mentioned a moment ago, just absolutely dazzled audiences. But their function, their purpose, was not just for the kind of pleasure and entertainment of a court. Often these were put on for really important what we might call state events. So in the event of a marriage of the son or daughter of the Grand Duchess, or some other kind of diplomatic encounter of the kind, these were seen primarily as a military art, so that in moments of peace, you could show off your ability to excel in things like war. So not only are equestrian ballets demonstrating the good horsemanship of the individual, so the future Grand Duke who's able to maneuver his horse well in the arena, but the ability of riders to move their steeds with rhythm and in sync with each other. So they're mimicking battle in what Costa calls in her libretto, sweet war, in order to show military readiness. So they are really a kind of total theater experience. And there's these marvelous festival books that are circulated to demonstrate to viewers, even from afar, what these might've looked like, with kind of giant fold out legends that show what the various horsemen are doing, showing various choreographic schema. They are intended to dazzle audiences, both in terms of the aesthetic, but also the military performance, but had gotten somewhat forgotten, much like Costa herself. So I do share your hope that these kinds of performances will gain traction. There's a wonderful colleague in French, French musicology, Kate Van Orden at Harvard, who had also studied these. But we associate the horsemanship with the Vienna school, but in reality, equestrian ballet was a phenomenon that seems to have started in France, but is really the purview of 17th century Italy, and among those courts, especially Florence, which has had an absolute love for this as a performative form.
So lovely. And I love calling it the Broadway of the 17th century. that in and of itself should just kind of be a new graduate seminar required of students, so we can learn more about this. And I'm just thinking about how the colors and the sounds of what it would be like to actually have experienced one of those. I'm turning now to a question that is probably now unfair, it's not meant to be. It's meant to learn more about which side of Costa is maybe your favorite, if you could identify one. But I also know that Costa, in her own, the way that she is an emblem of versatility, all Costas, like the prism of Costa, is the thing that is also just so fascinating. But was there a side of Costa's writing that you were surprised by, especially when you were either during the process of writing the book or by the time you got to the end of it, and after revisions and having her hard copy on your desk? Was there a way that you said, oh, either that was my favorite Costa or that was the Costa that I wasn't expecting to find?
I don't think it's an unfair question. I think it's an absolutely fair question. And I would say the same thing that I say when people ask me, which is my favorite Italian city? And it's whichever city I am in at the moment, right? I think that each one of her works is so, there are overlaps between them, but each one of them is so different and presents so many varying examples of her trying to experiment with literary tradition or experiment with the intersections between performance, music, and literature, that they are all a delight. That sounds like a cop out. I will give you some actual answers. I think the text that I indicated was helping for my choice of the cover portrait, her guitar, La Guitarra. I think the lure and surprise of having a text, it's almost 600 pages long, hundreds of examples of poems written by the voice of a bella donna, a beautiful woman, who in male authored poems is usually the kind of object of male desire, and she might be attractive, ugly, alluring in some way, but she's always voiced by some kind of male authorial presence. And Costa takes that bella donna and makes her own, so that she is her authorial persona. At the same time, in that collection, she opens up her first poem with a lengthy description in verse of her muse. And she says her muse is not going to be the beautiful, fine muses of classical tradition. Her muse is a wild, ugly, screeching banshee named Simona of Heliconas, so Simona of Helicon, who is going to do what she wants. and cannot be controlled. And so that pushing away of boundaries, I think for me, was one of the first early surprising and delightful things about Kalsa. And in that poem, she says, in the final poem of that collection, she says in another verse, "Don't raise your eyebrows at me," that women are not meant to write about serious things, that actually jocular, fun, satirical poetry is the purview of women above all else. But of course, Kalsa varies, and Kalsa is going to show off her virtuosity and change. And so I think that her Cecilia Marta, the poem about St. Cecilia, is one of her best written works in terms of the actual mechanics and the literary quality of the text. If I was ever to undertake another one of her translations, though, The Buffoons, I think, is certainly the most historically successful of her works and is fun to work with, and I think fun to have students read and engage with. If I were to undertake another translation, it would be her epic about the Grand Duchess's pregnancy, work called Flora Feconda, because I really think it's the work perhaps in which I see Kalsa most playing and transforming literary tradition, especially Ovid, but also figures like Virgil, and seeing how she can rewrite expectations in terms of voyage, myth, womanhood, gender, and performance, right? So I think that it's a traditional box, right? It's a Mediterranean epic in which she's being as most experimental as she can. I will say that Kalsa's versatility and her way in which she's writing in so many different genres was part of the fun of doing this project, but it was also part of the challenge. So she's active in all these different courts, with all these different patrons, with all these different genres. And so she's literally all over the map, literally in sense of the geography, but also in terms of her genre and register, relationships, etc. And so each one of the chapters for me felt like a full plunge journey into, for example, a chapter I write on her relationship to female regents. And usually Kalsa without her Irv is mostly interested in cultivating men, but she finds herself with some female regent patrons. And so is it having to explore emblems of female power. And so having to go to Turin and learn for myself all the dynamics of Turinese political messaging, performance types, all those kinds of things, and bringing it together in a way that was informative for how I see Kalsa interacting in her period there and writing about it after the fact. It was delightful, but it was quite a challenge, right? So she's, her virtuosity is what makes her interesting and makes her fun. The difficulty of putting her in a box, or the challenges presented by unweaving all of these various threads for a figure that, like many other figures like her, a woman who is not elite, who is a professional performer, the archives are often silent about figures like her. Mm-hmm. And so the difficulty of doing all that work while trying to find the needle in the haystack of what exactly she's doing and what can be documented and what has to be hypothesized, again, a challenge, though delight.
And you overcame the challenge. I mean, we're all so grateful for the amount of, I mean, tracing that you've done and the archival deep dives and trekking throughout all the cities. I mean, if you've shown her, you know, you've really put the stopper in the mouth of critics like Croce saying that she's just scribbling. No, she's incredibly, incredibly versatile and can truly like evade all boxes because she's checked so many. But the tantalizing hint that you might be interested in translating the Flora is really exciting too, because as you say, I mean, how do you make a genre that is so classic seem so modern and new, and doing it in the style of Virgil, no less? So that's exciting. What's also exciting is thinking about the new generation of new books readers who might eventually become new books writers, and thinking about Kalsa and our students. So you've mentioned, but I also want to make sure that you deserve your own praise, that your translation, you and Sarah Diaz's translation of the Bifoni, is a wonderful hit with students. This I can guarantee. I've taught classes on gendering the Renaissance, and students just think it's a hoot. And so I'm wondering, in your own experience in bringing Kalsa and students together, what settings have you done that in, and what kind of are students' reactions? If it is in, you know, maybe a women's history class or even a class on satire, I could see her working really, really well in. Just, yeah, if you have any anecdotes to share?
Yes, students, I think, like I would hope faculty members find in Costa a lot of surprises. And one of our colleagues, Sarah Ross in Boston, has coined the term weird humanism, in part looking at a figure like Margarita Costa, because she's, I think, if I can paraphrase Sarah, she says weird humanism is this kind of wanton experimentation. And I think students find that kind of unexpected playfulness in Costa delightful. And of course, surprises is one of the best ways to hook and capture students' imagination. So I taught Costa in two contexts. One was a course on Italian comedy that I did for our upper division Italian language students. And of course, reading something comedic in the original language, not as a native speaker, presents certain challenges. So we performed it out loud. They, you know, conveniently could go find our translation if they so desired. We performed it out loud. I will say that it was slightly humorous because we were performing it in part on a beautiful Tuscaloosa, Alabama springtime day. And I realized my students were discussing prostitutes and hunchbacks right in front of the dean's office. But hopefully that I saw that as a good pedagogical method.
Costa would have been proud.
She would have been absolutely proud. And the other place that I have taught Costa was twice. I've been a visiting professor at the University of Padua, the Università degli Studi di Padova in Padua, Italy, where I taught a kind of MA level course on Renaissance women writers. And I will say that sometimes when we're working on these figures within the US, it becomes challenging because of the lack of translations, right? So that if we're teaching a class that's taught in English, we're kind of limited in scope by what is available to us. And I hadn't really appreciated that the same degree is true when you're teaching in Italy because of the lack of modern editions. So I was teaching a graduate class on women writers in Italy, but the text, the primary text we wanted to work on from the 15th century to Costa's own day, were more available outside of Italy than inside of Italy. And so I think the students in that class, not only did they find Costa a kind of fun and delightful surprise because they are so accustomed in their education to what the kind of satirical writer Anton Francesco Grazzini, who's known as Lasca, described as petrarchisms and bembisms, this kind of traditional literary language of lyric poetry that they're used to. They really found it surprising that there are so many women writers, especially in 16th century Italy, of which they simply were not aware. And I think thinking forward to the challenges of teaching figures like this, both in Italy and in the US in the Italian context, it has to be one of access. And if I was going to put out a call for, you know, how to help solve these problems, the lack of modern editions in Italy and, the, you know, the need for greater numbers of translations in the US. And of course, there are more and more translations of Costa. And indeed, my colleague Sarah Diaz is working on one on her amorous letters that will be coming out soon. I would really hope that there will be in the future more anthologies and readers in the sense of collected works for the study of either theater or women writers or performance or all of these things put together or versions thereof. We have currently Virginia Cox's Lyric Poetry by Women in the Italian Renaissance, but that's very focused on, of course, by its title, you would guess, lyric poetry, and it doesn't expand to include figures like Costa for purely chronological reasons. And so I think for all of us, our ability to teach these figures will be aided by our ability to kind of place them together in a way that is accessible or downloadable, as the case might be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful call. I mean, I think so much could come out of that collaboratively too. I mean, really mm-hmm. taking the best advantage of these different, all of our different colleagues working across different areas of specialization, and then using those forces and doing things online and making that so it an addition would be available, you know, between the states and in Italy and elsewhere. So much good things to look forward to. So the last question, just as we're wrapping things up, this is just such an amazing accomplishment. Again, congratulations. This is you know, just a fabulous, fabulous accomplishment, really. And so I'm wondering, what's next? I know that you're at the Newbery now, and so you're wrapping up this fellowship. Are we going back to the sack of Rome of those stories of torture found you again? Are you finding other ways to evade them, or where's the research boat going now?
I am, as you say, back in Chicago, working on back in the sack of Rome, trying to write my study of the literary repercussions of the sack in time for the 500-year anniversary that's coming up in 2027. So the sack is a fair amount of discussion of the brutality that befalls bodies, but the way I'm reading it is also the ways in which Italian literary culture opens up after the sack, in part out of necessity to find new voices. And so those voices will include women writers. And so the distance between the two projects is not maybe as net as it might seem. But after that, after I'm past the sack, one thing that Costa has given me is, I think, an appreciation for festival, spectacle, and performance as these kind of moments of experimentation. And so I think that down the road, my path will be looking towards Renaissance and Baroque materials that I've been collecting as I've been working on these various things to think about gender, the body, travel, discovery, imagination, as presented not only by the spectacle, but the festival books that come after that. So to be determined on what exact shape that will take, but it will certainly be putting a lot of these same questions about how do we relate to patrons? How do we present, fresh and innovative ideas within familiar packages? How do we push the boundaries of what is possible?
That's so exciting. Well, one more applause for you. And again, just thank you so much for this conversation. I hope that everyone listening just is overwhelmed by all the things that we talked about it in all the good best of ways. And just to encourage everyone, yeah, now to get your hands on Margherita Costa, Diva of the Baroque Court, published 2023, University of Toronto Press. So thank you again, Jessica. This is wonderful.
Thank you, Kate. Thank you so much for having me.